1039 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. We welcome you to another edition of Feldis and Kale. A delight to have you along with us. The program is presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And our guest today is a Nashua resident, a dad of three, and co-owner at Revision Energy, New Hampshire's largest clean energy company. And we're talking about Dan Weeks. Dan, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
It is our pleasure. Great to have you along with us. So what can you tell us about Revision Energy?
Sure. Well, we are a solar and clean energy company, meaning we do a bunch of complementary technologies in addition to harnessing the sun. The basic idea is that, you know, we got a lot of sun shining on a day like today and through most of the summer and a lot of the rest of the year in New Hampshire. And can we generate our own power rather than being reliant on imported and not so clean electricity from out of state or even abroad? So we harness that sunlight, have been working with thousands of families, businesses, nonprofits, towns over the last almost two decades. And then you want to put that to as many different uses as possible. So Revision also will take that solar generation with solar panels that we install and use it to heat and cool your home with air source heat pumps, also to deal with your transportation needs. So electric vehicles are getting pretty popular and expected to be ramping up pretty fast in the coming years. And then storing that power for nighttime or rainy days as well when the power goes out, especially through battery systems. So that's pretty much what we do. Been around for, like I said, almost 20 years. Started actually up in Maine and spread across northern New England, as well as down to Mass these days. And I'm really proud to be an employee-owned company, which means that my nearly 300 co-owners and I are joint partners in this on this journey. And that includes a whole lot of, you know, more senior folks like me, but also a lot of 20-somethings just getting started as an electrical apprentice who have equity in the business and are doing, we think, an even better job because of it.
Well, for our listeners, Dan Weeks is just a wonderful friend, a great community advocate, an issues-oriented, solutions-oriented, common-sense leader on the community and clean energy and so many other issues. And Dan, you've done so much great work over the years, including related to the issues that you just talked about and what Revision works on. We've made some progress over the years and certainly there's some challenges. Let's talk first about some of the gains, including community solar, and how is that playing out on the ground?
Yeah, well, so New Hampshire has, thanks actually to our former Senate Majority Leader, Dan Feltis, pushing through a really important bipartisan compromise, which was signed by the governor and got support from across the aisle, a bill, SB 165, two or so years ago. And this created a community solar program that was especially focused on enabling low-income folks get access to the solar resource. A lot of folks, when you hear solar, you think, well, sounds nice. It's for rich people and environmentalists. And to be honest, that's been true too much of the time in the past. If you go back a decade or two, solar was wicked expensive, and so you had to have a lot of money to be able to put it on your roof or in your field. Fortunately, the cost curve has gone in the right direction. The cost of installed solar is about 80% less than it was a decade ago, so it's affordable to a lot more people, but not to everybody yet, and that's where this particular bill, SB 165, really came in. And what this did, and we're starting to see your question, Dan, about how it's actually getting deployed. Never quickly enough, because it takes a while to develop projects and get utility approval. There are some roadblocks that we encounter, but we are now able to provide the power needs of low-income Granite Staters, anybody earning up to three times the federal poverty level, so that's $60,000 or $70,000 for a typical family. If your income is less than that, you're able to join a community solar effort. And the value of that generated electricity, which is then reflected on your monthly electric bill from the utility, is a little bit higher than what it would otherwise be. New Hampshire is unique in the region in that we have the lowest value of solar by far, by a factor of 2 to 4, depending on what state you're comparing to, which means solar is kind of underpriced in New Hampshire, a little bit harder to make the numbers pencil for particularly families with less money. But thanks to this legislation, we've been able to get some exciting projects going. There's a resident-owned community, a mobile home community up in Lebanon, New Hampshire, called Mascoma Meadows that's been solar-powered for a few years now. Dozens of residents there are saving several hundred dollars a year off their electric. We've worked with a couple other of these resident-owned mobile home communities around the state. Particularly excited to be doing more of that work, some other projects in the pipeline, and also have worked for some years now with a lot of affordable housing developers. You know, down in the Monadnock region, Keene Housing, we put over 50 rooftop solar arrays on their roofs, serving folks in that community who need some help with affording housing. We know it's very expensive in New Hampshire. Done likewise in the Lakes region and the Seacoast. So we're seeing some good moves, Dan, but as you know, New Hampshire is still rather far behind our neighbors, and so we need to overcome some additional barriers to really catch up.
And one additional progress point, if you will, was the passage of community aggregation that we worked on together and others, and that was also bipartisan. There's another bill kind of refining that, but the community power, community aggregation, talk a little bit about the value of that in opening up this market.
Yeah, this is really exciting, Dan, what's possible here and what's going to come. It's a question of will it come soon enough, frankly, to meet the environmental challenges, the climate challenges that we face. But the basic idea is, you know, right now you're locked in. You got your utility service provider, and depending on where you live, there's one and only one. It's a regulated monopoly. And then you do have the freedom to choose who the supplier is. So the poles and wires are owned by one and only one utility. But in terms of who's generating or supplying that electricity, the electrons that flow through the wires, you get choice in that since we deregulated the electricity market. So that means, you know, my family for years has been choosing a green supplier. When we're not getting our power from the solar on our roof in the middle of winter, we can have the benefit of green power from a third-party supplier. However, by and large, most Granite Staters are still getting their supply from not-so-clean sources of energy and not-so-local sources of energy, for that matter. For good and maybe not so good in terms of cost of electricity, which is very high in this region, we're not sitting on big fossil fuel reserves. So most of our energy, not just electricity, but for transportation and heating and cooling, is coming from out of state. About 80%, 80 to 85% of it is non-renewable between nuclear and especially fossil fuels. And so that means that Granite Staters are spending out of state some $5 billion a year to import non-renewable energy. What this community power program will enable, and we're going to see this in the next few years, is for communities to basically become their own power suppliers. The utility is still the utility, managing the poles and wires, distributing the electrons. But in terms of the generation of that power to supply the homes and businesses in the community, you can have communities step up now and actually put that cap landfill to some productive purpose, put a whole bunch of solar panels on it, or maybe some wind turbines or other renewable generators in the community, thereby creating good local jobs, saving folks money. All ratepayers, not just those who are maybe directly connected to the asset, but who are receiving their power through the grid from that generator, and, of course, helping the environment, because so much of that energy today is non-renewable, is creating this phenomenon of global warming, which is a challenge that we're realizing the consequences of. But instead, by going local, we've got more local investment, more local jobs, and a cleaner environment in the process.
Our guest is Dan Weeks, one of the co-owners, one of several hundred co-owners at Revision Energy, New Hampshire's largest clean energy company. We have to take a quick break, and Dan will stay with us here on 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, Feltus and Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Welcome back, Feltus and Kale at 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And our guest is Dan Weeks. Very interesting guy, Dan. I read your bio, and you were really introduced to solar in a somewhat unusual fashion.
That is right. Back in the 90s, so grew up around here, down the Manoc region, Temple, New Hampshire, and a proud graduate of Conval High School. And a little embarrassed to tell you who the sponsor of this particular club I was in, the solar car team. It was sponsored by Enron way back when, before some stuff went down. But needless to say, we had this solar car team in the 90s, which we built this car called the Soul Survivor 1 and then Soul Survivor 2. And it had a pretty small, pretty old and heavy, clunky battery on board. And we had, I think around 375 watts of solar cells covering every top-facing surface of the car. And it could kind of manage one rather skinny guy or girl as the pilot, as the driver. And we would take it around the region and compete against some of the big guys like MIT. We actually did pretty well, won a couple of races. But it was a neat chance for me to start to realize what the potential of this resource was. Yeah, solar had been was being piloted in other parts of the country and of the world. So it wasn't a brand new idea. The idea of harnessing sunlight to generate electricity goes back several decades, in fact, but it wasn't being deployed on any scale to speak of. And so it was kind of a distant dream that someday I would actually get to drive on solar, power my home on solar, heat the home and all that. And nowadays, fortunately enough, that future is here, and I can drive all over New Hampshire in my Chevy Bolt and plug in at home and get the power from our solar panels and all that. So it was fun to start dabbling back then in the 90s. Had to wait a while until we were really seeing the cost come down and the deployment go up as a result. But that future really is here, and I'm proud to say that the industry is maturing, that the jobs are there. When we talk about future economic opportunity and keeping our young people in state, adding a lot of good living wage jobs for future generations, I think this is a real opportunity for New Hampshire.
Well, that future is certainly here, Dan, and the jobs of tomorrow are in clean energy among many other fields, and certainly in terms of attracting and retaining young workers and families, it's a big issue too. And Dan, we talked in the opening segment about some of the gains that we've made over the last few years, bipartisan gains in advancing community solar and advancing community aggregation. What are some of the public policies that are holding New Hampshire back from really opening up access to solar savings and advancing this market?
Thanks for that, Dan. I love New Hampshire like you both do too, of course, and I love to sing our praises. But I do have to say that as a general matter, when it comes to comprehensive policy to harness this resource locally and add the local jobs and the cost savings, we are really far behind, is the truth. So just to put it in perspective, right now, today, the state of Massachusetts gets close to 20% of its electricity on an annual basis from the sun. State of Vermont's about 15%. Maine started at half of 1% just 2 years ago and is now well over 1% and adding several percentage points a year at the current rate. New Hampshire has yet to break 1%. It's about 0.9%. And the difference is not a different climate, you know, same amount of sunlight basically falls in our three states, same amount of land mass when you compare New Hampshire, Mass, and Vermont, but it's policy. And so, unfortunately, we do have a governor currently and members of one of the parties that has been opposed to allowing the growth of local renewables for reasons that, to be honest, made sense a while ago, just don't quite fit with the data today, with all due respect. And to put that in perspective, the value of solar as it is priced today in New Hampshire, because we have a very low goal or renewable portfolio standard in the state, it corresponds to a value of solar that is also very low, about 6.7 cents per kilowatt hour for an array of 100 kilowatts or larger. And I know those are just numbers, but think of your local elementary school. An array that size gets a value of solar at 6.7 cents. If you go over to Maine, the value of that same kilowatt hours of solar is twice as much. If you go down to Mass or over to Vermont, it's between 3 and 5 times as much. And that is not just because those states like going green. It's actually because those states have gone through a process of studying the costs and the benefits of solar to the grid. They've looked at the fact that solar peaks when the demand on the grid peaks. So when we're, you know, got those ACs cranking on a hot summer day, that's the same time that the solar output is the greatest. And so you're actually saving everybody a bundle of money because you're not having to turn on the peaker power plant. That's the dirty, distant power plant, and losing 40% of the generation just by sending it over the poles and wires. You're actually generating it locally, distributed throughout the community. So our neighboring states have done that process. They've studied the actual costs and benefits. They've set some real goals. And as a result, they are just miles and miles, frankly, a decade or so ahead of New Hampshire. And that means we've lost out on a lot of jobs, and we're spending a lot more on electricity than we have to.
Absolutely.
But a big,
go ahead, Dan.
Please come right back in, Dan. I don't want to hog the floor here.
Oh, I was just going to add, when folks talk about electric rates and bills, I think it's important to note, Ken, and to listeners, that the highest growing portion of your electric bill is regional transmission costs. And those regional transmission costs allocated to the state of New Hampshire or to any state is a function of your peak demand, largely. So when Dan talks about shaving peak demand by having solar up, that's a benefit to ratepayers and certainly in the medium to long term. And we've been losing out. And there's a reason why our rates are going up higher than around surrounding states. And the surrounding states are investing more in energy efficiency and solar. And so if you had a magic wand, Dan, and you could say, here's 2 or 3 public policies that need to be changed and to what levels, that kind of thing, what would those be to really explode the solar market and the jobs here in New Hampshire?
Well, one thing would be to pass a bill that is sitting right there in front of our state lawmakers in Concord as we speak and going through final negotiations. House Bill 315, which had an amendment added to it of the contents of Senate Bill 109. And specifically what this does is take an incremental step to achieving something that you, Dan, as senator, worked on for several years, which had a strong bipartisan support, but did run into some vetoes, and that is to raise the project cap on the size that you can build a net metered clean energy generator, whether it's solar or hydro or wind. Right now, that's 1 megawatt. Every neighboring state is at least 5 megawatts. 1 megawatt is kind of the size of a decent-sized high school roof or about 4 acres of land. So this would allow you to go a bit bigger than that. And this particular bill would apply only to the public sector. So towns and cities, school districts, water sewer districts, counties. This wouldn't let private investors take advantage. It wouldn't let businesses take advantage, which we frankly think they should be able to do like they do in all of the neighboring states. But it would be just for the public sector to finally put those old capped landfills to use or other brownfields or other lands that they can't do anything productive with and start saving local taxpayers money. So that bill, HB 315, if it was passed, would be an important step forward. The other big thing, and I'll mention just this one more, there's a lot of small stuff that I would say could also be done to enable the kind of growth that we're seeing in the region. But the one other key thing is that we need to set some real goals as a state. You might have heard of the thing called RPS, Renewable Portfolio Standard. That's where we say this is what the state of New Hampshire strives to achieve in terms of our energy mix. And right now, our goal is 0.7% of electricity coming from the sun. And it's not much better for wind or hydro. We do get a bit more from biomass. So total renewables, 25%, but solar, 0.7%. which is a small fraction of where, again, the rest of the region is. By setting such a low goal, we basically send the signal to companies, to developers, that New Hampshire isn't really open for business. So, yeah, as Revision Lucky, we've been here a long time. We've got a strong footprint. So, frankly, having less competition probably helps our bottom line in New Hampshire. But we want a healthy ecosystem. We want other companies to say, oh, New Hampshire's actually serious. They want to generate their own power. we're going to, you know, move into the state, or we're going to open a new business in the state. 4 years ago, we had 40% more solar companies in New Hampshire, but because we've failed to keep pace, we've lost 40% of our companies. We've lost about 20-25% of our solar workforce. We want to go in the opposite direction. My company wants to have more competition. We want to see these opportunities, but the state has to use that tool of the renewable portfolio standard and set a meaningful goal and set a value of solar that corresponds to it.
What are your thoughts on HB 315? Does it have a chance of passing, Dan?
It definitely does. You know, we have, again, strong bipartisan support, and to his credit, the governor has said that he actually supports raising the net metering cap in this targeted way for the public sector. Unfortunately, there are members of the House who are not so comfortable looking at getting a poison pill amendment added to it. So it's going to be some tough negotiations. On the Senate side, Dan's friend, Senator Jeb Bradley, the Republican Majority Leader, Senator Kevin Avard, who chairs the committee there in the Senate, they're strongly behind it. They're pushing hard for it. But we do have a bit of a tough road in the House.
And I know, Dan, you made a foray into the political world yourself.
My wife would rather forget, but yeah, back in 2016, made a run for executive council down here in District 5, Nashua, out to the Monadnock area, and it was a fun campaign. I felt really honored to get out there and get to meet a whole lot of people, and as it happened, we had twins that same year, and we've had a third little guy since, so like I was saying, my wife is kind of pleased that it didn't quite pan out, and I feel very lucky to be busy in the private sector doing something I love, and also engaged in policy. I care about a lot of different issues, clean energy and many others. And so New Hampshire is a great place for politics to be an active citizen. There's a lot of ways to make your voice heard, and I feel fortunate to be doing that.
And you certainly have been raising your voice, Dan, on so many critical issues, including the so-called divisive concepts legislation that was attached to the budget. Can you tell us a little bit about what that language does and what are your thoughts on it and concerns about it?
Yes, thanks for that question. This one really has been weighing me down and a lot of folks down in New Hampshire. House Bill 544 is where it began. It was then amended onto HB 2, the budget bill. And what this bill does, it's modeled off of an executive order that the former president issued that was then struck down as unconstitutional. But it basically says that you can't teach, if you're public school or university, if you're a state agency, and even the House version would say any state contractor, so any business or nonprofit that does any work at all for the state, even if it does a tiny amount of its business for the state, as Revision does. We've been honored to be awarded a few projects over the years, but most of our work is not with the state. But any of those entities would also be prohibited from teaching and training around the truth, unfortunately, the truth of systemic racism in New Hampshire. So it basically considers that a divisive concept. And there's a lot of language in the bill, which honestly sounds good, but it's a little bit of a wolf in sheep's clothing, I would say, in making it illegal to teach these core concepts about the continued reality of systemic racism. I recently wrote a piece with my wife, who's a human rights law professor, in some state papers, which goes through rather systematically the many different manifestations of systemic racism in New Hampshire, how it is actually part of our reality. And it's something that I've gotten to see a little bit more up close than I ever expected growing up in New Hampshire as a person of European descent, but now happening to be married to a woman from South Africa and having three little kids who are considered black by society and who are being treated differently. I wish it wasn't so, but that is something that we're having to live with. And my wife being, you know, called the N-word in public, told to go back to where she belongs, even though she's a citizen and a professor and all the rest. So there's that reality, and it's not just those individual instances, but more importantly, I would suggest it's the structures that continue these inequities where an African-American kid in New Hampshire is 3 to 5 times more likely to be arrested for doing the same thing as a kid of European descent, and then 5 to 6 times more likely to actually be incarcerated for that. And the list goes on and on. But this is stuff that, unfortunately, this bill in the legislature, which is now part of the budget, would make it illegal to teach about. And we hope very much that the governor will follow through. He said that he would veto it, although he's left some wiggle room there on possible amendments. It's something that the private sector in New Hampshire overwhelmingly opposed. We've gotten close to 300 businesses and nonprofits to sign up publicly. We had a full-page ad in Union Leader a couple Sundays ago to say, this is wrong for New Hampshire. It'll give us a black eye. It'll make it hard to attract the kind of workforce we need to keep growing our economy, never mind keep our young people in state. But in spite of that, there does unfortunately seem to be a strong will in the legislature to ram this through the budget. So we're trying to oppose it.
Well, I've never seen anything like this attached to the budget. Obviously, there's some other things that are attached to the budget that it's just strange to do that. And, it's really playing to, I think, the far right sort of fringe here. I mean, this is not the New Hampshire way. Look, we value debate. We don't fear it. We value freedom of speech. We don't censor it. We don't cancel out people who are teaching different concepts. That's just not the way to go. And I think it, in my view anyways, Ken and Dan, it does give New Hampshire a black eye. It's going to affect our ability to attract and retain workers. And Dan, you live it every day, in terms of attracting and retaining workers. You live an experience that you talked about with your family every day too. Just talk about what this means and what message this would send nationwide if this went through.
It would send a message, Dan, that New Hampshire is afraid of the truth, and that we don't welcome diversity and diverse perspectives, which, by the way, actually make businesses more productive and more effective. If you're always around people who think and act just like you, you're not going to get that edge. You're not going to get those new ideas, those inputs. You're not going to be able to speak to a broader customer base, et cetera. So I think it sends a message, kind of like I was saying before, in our energy policy, where we're basically saying, no, we're not open for business when it comes to clean energy. This also sends the message that, if you're looking to, join a dynamic organization or plant a business that's going to be future-focused, that's going to attract diverse talent, that's going to speak to the issues of the current and future generations, Don't come to New Hampshire. We don't want you here. So I think it's a dumb business decision. I think that's the reason we've gotten, again, close to 300 businesses and nonprofits to say no. And those aren't just mom and pops. Those are Fidelity Investments. Those are Dartmouth Hitchcock, the largest employer in the state. Belcro, UNH, SNHU, Dartmouth, on down the list. Some pretty heavy hitters, as well as the Business and Industry Association, which represents the largest businesses too in the state. They've all come out against it. So I think it's a no-brainer from the economy standpoint, and it's just the wrong thing to do. Like you said, we're better than this. We're braver than this. We can face these truths and become a better state for everybody.
Our guest is Dan Weeks, and Dan is one of the co-owners at Revision Energy, part of the solar staff there. And we're going to take a break right here. It's Feldis and Kale, and I hope you can stay with us for a few more minutes, Dan. You have some great ideas, and I want to probe a little bit more into your past as well, because something I read about you really intrigues me. Okay? Can you stay with us?
I look forward to it. Thanks.
All right. Dan Weeks is with us. We'll take a break. Feldis and Kale is proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. We are back, 103.9, 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, Feldis and Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Dan Weeks is with us of Revision Energy, and they deal in solar. But I want to go back to a time, Dan, that I read about you in 2012, 2013, traveling the country by Greyhound bus on a budget of $16 a day. So tell us what your mission was.
Well, that one was even crazier than my campaign. But I'll give you the quick backstory on this. We were actually living in South Africa, my wife and I, shortly after we got married, before the kids came along. Needless to say, she would not let me do that with three kids at home that I would not be helping with. But we were living in South Africa for a few years there. She was teaching at the university, and part of the deal before I could get her to settle here in New Hampshire, where my heart was, is that I had to put in a few years there, and it was a wonderful experience, really expanding for me. And something that I was struck by was just how blatant the poverty and inequality is there, South Africa being the most income unequal country on earth. As I would go on to learn, the U.S. is unfortunately the most unequal country among developed or advanced economies. And I was kind of given eyes to see something that I hadn't really seen before. I grew up in poverty light, so to speak, which is my folks didn't earn much money. You know, we worked jobs from a young age to buy our baseball gloves and whatnot. But we did have the backstops. My grandparents were there if there was a health crisis or, you know, to help with whatever it may be. So it wasn't like a real experience of deprivation. But living for that time in South Africa helped me to see my country and some of the challenges that we face that I had kind of glossed over before. And I was also working for a number of years on the issue, as Dan knows, of trying to make our democracy a little bit truer to its name, ensuring that everybody, regardless of rich or poor, has a say in our political process. And I decided that, you know, I'd spent time working in legislatures, also with Congress, to try to get some laws passed. I hadn't really taken it to ground level to look at, well, what is the human cost of this economic and also this political inequality? And there's a kind of feedback loop there where if you're economically poor, it's really hard to have an equal say in politics. You can't exactly fund campaigns or mount your own campaign. You can't, you find it harder to vote and on down the list. So I decided to do this Greyhound tour, made it through 30 states, kept a poverty line budget, which works out to $16 per person per day. So that was enough to cover my bus fare and not a lot of food and certainly no accommodation. So I didn't starve or anything, but I did sleep most nights either on the bus or in a bus station or camping out with some homeless folks or just on a random public bench or some random homestays with a family out in the desert in New Mexico, for example, Skid Row in L.A., a lot of really eye-opening experiences. And I tried to document, did a lot of interviews with folks who were very, very open to share their stories and tried to pull all the pieces together in a little book called Democracy and Poverty, A View from Below. And it was an effort, again, to understand a little bit more of some of the work we have to do. I love this country and consider myself a patriot, but part of being a patriot in my eyes is posing those tough challenges and working on them and to try to deepen my work, particularly on the democracy side of things, to make sure that everybody, rich or poor, has an equal voice.
And I'm sure that experience over those months was a true eye-opener for you.
Oh, my gosh. I could spend way more time than we have just sharing stories. The incredible resilience of people, the heartbreak of what folks go through, the determination to make a better life, and yet the obstacles that they face. I got to say, it does relate to my present concern around systemic racism, where a lot of those obstacles just don't need to be there, in my view. But we've got to face them, and we've got to work through them.
And just tell us a little bit about the book that you just mentioned, Democracy and Poverty, A View from Below.
That book, it's selling for a poverty line price of a dollar in electronic format on Amazon, so anybody can look it up or can Google it. And there's also a series of articles that I was honored to write for The Atlantic and other talks and things. But again, it tries to document political, the intersection between political equality and economic equality, or the lack thereof, and to make the case ultimately that poverty isn't just an economic problem. Folks don't have enough money, not enough jobs or educational opportunity. It's also a political problem. And that gets you into the systemic or structural dimension of things, that it's not quite enough. It's good to look at individuals, absolutely, but that's not quite enough. You do have to look at the systems, too. Why is it that a kid of African descent, an African-American child, is born with one-tenth the family wealth of a kid of European descent? Why that 10-to-1 gap? And why is it going to take us another 228 years to get to equality on the path we're on? What systemic forces are at play there? So wanting to encourage myself and any reader to think about individual stories, but kind of follow those through to what are the systemic arrangements that do make it harder for some people in communities to realize the American dream.
Dan, you've done so much work and advocated on so many issues and made so much progress. What advice would you give to someone who is, you know, maybe in high school or just starting out in college, who wants to get active and involved and engaged? What's some advice that you would give to them?
Find your passion. I count myself really lucky that back in high school when I was doing the solar car thing, I also got to meet an amazing Granite Stater, a hero of mine, who some listeners will know as Granny D, Doris Haddock, a.k.a. Granny D. She passed away over a decade ago at the age of 100, but she was someone who lived in the town next door, who had walked across the country for democracy, for reform, when she was 90 years old, and I just happened to meet her and hear her story, and she lit a fire under me. So for me, that early passion, which I was just so lucky to encounter as a teenager, was around making our democracy real. But if for another young person out there, it's animal rights, it's anti-racism, it's poverty or hunger or what have you, find what excites you. And then follow it through. Find the organizations that are leading on that issue. There's so many great nonprofits all over New Hampshire, in Concord, but in every corner of the state as well, that are always looking for volunteers. Just plug in, take that first step, and it's going to lead to such amazing opportunities to realize your purpose. And then that can change over time. I didn't start out I did some solar dabbling as a teen, but I didn't go right into the private sector, into industry. So your careers will change, your journey will unfold in all sorts of unexpected ways. But by finding a passion, pursuing it, you will just realize joy and purpose like I couldn't have otherwise imagined. You know, I certainly did all the teenager things as well, but as I began to get involved in some issues and meet some leaders who had been doing the work for a long time, who kind of took me under their wing, amazing folks like John Rao at Americans for Campaign Reform, from whom I got to learn so much and grow as a leader, that just brought whole new worlds for me of, you know, being able to make a contribution.
Well, bringing up Granny D, that conjures up a lot of memories because she was very prominent and such a trailblazer in this state of New Hampshire at, as you mentioned, a very elderly age, walking across the country to create an awareness. And she is a great inspiration, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So just take us through the solar process as we get back now to Revision Energy for a moment. You mentioned that we are behind here in New Hampshire compared to our contemporaries in Maine and also in Vermont and Massachusetts. So what if someone wants to go solar? What are the steps? How do you begin if they want to be like you and energize your home with solar and your vehicle as well? How do people get started?
Well, I appreciate you bringing it back to that, because it certainly is my day in, day out passion, and I'd love to answer that. I know I was a bit glum about the state of policy, where we've got some work to do, but at the end of the day, I like to say I'm blessed to be in an industry where the fuel source is free, the sun keeps shining, and so if you've got a sunny roof, chances are you'll be able to save a bundle of money with solar. So if you're a homeowner, a little more complicated if you don't own your roof. It's not impossible, but I'll be honest, there's some additional hurdles. You obviously got to get the person who does own the roof to agree. We can talk to them. But if you do own that roof and it's not too old and in need of replacement, generally 10, 15-year-old roofs, usually okay, although we'll do an inspection. Anything newer is definitely going to be good to go. And as long as it's not too shaded, there may be some tree trimming you want to do, like we did at our home here in Nashua. Then, pretty simple process. Revision or any other good local company can send out one of our designers. They'll come out, climb up on your roof, take a bunch of measurements, figure out just how much sun shines on that roof based on what the orientation is and the pitch and the shade conditions and all the rest. You know, look in your basement at your electric panel, make sure that it's appropriately sized and all the rest. And within a week or so, they'll turn around a design and a proposal. And a lot of folks might want to be in a position to save up, or a lot of other folks will take out a solar loan. And the nice thing in that case is generally you're just swapping your electric bill for a solar loan payment. So for most folks who finance their systems, it's cash flow neutral or even positive. So you're not out of pocket any money. And then after that 10-year term, or if you pay up front, maybe it's even just a 7 or 8 year payback. Once you've paid it off, you own your power for the next decade. Solar panels come with a 25-year warranty and a commercial lifespan 40 years or more. So you're going to pay that system back multiple times over the lifetime. And as we know, grid prices keep going up, as Dan said, especially in the transmission and delivery side of things. So that solar generation, what you're not buying from the grid, will become more valuable over time. But it's honestly a pretty simple process. And if you do decide to go ahead, once you've gotten this proposal, the install itself is probably 2 days, sometimes wow. Even a single day or three if it's a large and complicated roof. But it's quite easy to get it done and hooked up, and you're off to the races.
Outstanding. Well, how do they get in touch? What is the best way to start out and get involved?
Well, thanks so much for asking. If they want to learn about Revision or connect with one of our local solar designers, the website is always there at revisionenergy.com. They can also call our Brentwood shop. We've got two New Hampshire offices. The one nearest you all is in Brentwood, New Hampshire by Exeter, and that's 679-1777. Or if you want to get in touch with me directly, I admit I don't work on our smaller projects, but certainly help out a lot of cities and towns and larger businesses as well. So anybody can give me a ring at 264-2877 or email me at dweeks@revisionenergy.com.
Dan, we appreciate you being with us today, and lots of great insight into solar and other issues as well. Truly a great chat, and we hope to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Dan.
Dan Weeks from Revision Energy, located in Brentwood. We'll take a quick break here as we head down the home stretch. It's Feldis and Kale, 1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. We are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Welcome back, and we don't have very much time left on this edition of Feldis and Kale here on 1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. But Dan, I do want to point out that I know you'll be spending some time on the seacoast in the not-too-distant future. But today, June 15th, is National Lobster Day. You a lobster guy? Do you like lobster?
You know, Ken, I've had it once.
Once?
And the only reason why it was only once is because I then discovered that I have a shellfish allergy.
Oh.
Now, I had had shrimp prior, and occasionally it would... there'd be some aggravation, but the lobster experience prompted me to get it checked out, and it turns out I have more allergies than just shellfish. But
oh, wow.
How about you? Are you a lobster
person?
I love
it. I love it. Yep. I could have it every day. I wish I could afford it every day. But at any rate, Dan, great to be with you.
And you got it.
Thanks to Dan Weeks, our guest. Feldis and Kale, 1039-1450 WKXL, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion.